lot of thought went into it. I'm going to qualify myself for being here. I used to use drugs and alcohol. I couldn't stop. I first came to NA in 86 via a psych ward and treatment facility. I married the first guy I met at a meeting. Had two kids. This is my very condensed version. He was very abusive. In the early 90s, he stabbed me and went to prison. I relapsed in 94 with 8 years clean. I only relapsed on alcohol because I said I'd never do drugs again. That was a lie. I was out there for 6 years, and the higher power that I didn't really believe in saved me. I came in, you know, there's so many different types of grief. It can be, I have a cheat sheet here. I really put a lot of thought into this one. You know, I was thinking about grief in my lifetime. What have I grieved? You know, probably when I was young, the loss of a pet. Because they were family. Then my grandparents. And I'm going to be 61 on Monday, and it was different back then. Thank you. Grandparents weren't as active with their grandkids back in those days. You only saw them on holidays, or if they were babysitting once in a while. And there was grief, but it, you know, self-centered kids, you know, just, you know, you go on with life. You know, I lost my mom in 2016. That was devastating. And I watched her die in hospice, which was just tripled it. So, you know, people grieve relationship breakups bad. I mean, that is a form of grief. It could be a job that, your dream job that you lose. You know, people go through all kinds of grief, you know, in ways we expect people to die, you know, old age, ill, you know, people die from illness, accidents, drug abuse, just suddenly, miscarriages, you know, and I know when I was young, I never thought about loss, you know, I just didn't, you know, I thought just old people die eventually, but you do, you know, blocked death. I think maybe that's where I learned how to compartmentalize. I'm very good at compartmentalizing in my brain and storing things that are uncomfortable so I don't have to think about them. And then when it happens, it's like, not good. But what I learned is it's okay to cry and talk about things. And lots of hugs. It's okay to, if you have to seek outside help, to go to grief counseling and groups. For me, and this is just my story, my grief was so bad that I had to go on antidepressants for a short amount of time because my heart was so heavy. I thought I was going to kill myself. Either blatantly just kill myself or go back to using drugs. And I would rather kill myself than do drugs, so I sought outside help. And it was for a brief time, and it did lift the heaviness off my heart, and then I got off of them. And I can completely feel again. Of course, it was no narcotics involved in that. But I found the best way to honor our loved ones is to give back and help others. Because you're going to meet somebody who needs your help, who is going through something that you've been through. You know, they talk about the dash. That would be 1962 for me, and what's in between till my death. And it's so important in what we do in that period of time. And that's why I'm standing here right now. I lost a lot of faith. what I can tell you was my greatest loss. My daughter Samantha, September 4th of 21, I had a stroke that day. Let me back up. I took her off the streets during COVID because I thought the world was ending. I really did. Everything shut down. No human contact, you know. I went looking for her and I took her off the streets. And I knew she would still go and get what she had to get because treatment centers weren't open. Methadone clinics, you know, everything would just shut down. And my daughter was one of the worst addicts I had ever seen. And I've been in these rooms for a long time, you know, by the grace of God. In August, I'll celebrate 23 years. And I didn't use after she died, and that's huge, because that was my one reservation. I don't want to talk too long. Okay. Give me a minute. I love you too.
Take your time.
You know, I believe the way God works. The God that I didn't believe in when I came in these rooms, but came to believe. I came to believe in God because there were so many times I should have been dead. I came to believe because I saw other people who were hopeless find a new way to live besides myself. I believe that God works, and for everything bad that happens, there's a greater purpose. And like I said, I'm filling that dash in, trying to help others. It's not about me anymore. Anyway, back to my daughter. The day, you know, I took her off the streets during COVID, and one Saturday morning we were watching America's Got Talent on my phone because I don't have cable because I'm cheap, and I couldn't talk. All I could say was and she freaked out. She called my son. My son had borrowed my car to go fishing. And he came right home. Him and I don't get along too well, so that was a miracle. And he rushed me to Franklin Square. They have a stroke unit, even though Franklin Square sucks. They have a stroke unit there, and they're very good. And they were able to save my life. And I was immediately admitted. I was in a room within 2 hours. And at the fourth hour, my ex-husband and his wife showed up in my room, and I wondered why they were letting him in because of the COVID restrictions. And I get along really, really good with my ex-husband's wife, believe it or not. And she was crying, and I was so touched. She cares about me that much. She's so upset that I had a stroke. And I laughed. I said, I'm going to be okay. And she started crying more, and I laughed again. I said, I'm going to be okay. And she pulled her mask down and said, tell her, Kurt. Stephen, my son found my daughter dead in the living room. And I didn't use when I got out. That was my one reservation. What I did was I threw myself back into the program, and I remember something my daughter told me because she almost died earlier that year. She had shot into an aneurysm. I mean, this is just the horrors of drug addiction. She had shot into an aneurysm and bled out almost all her blood. Her kidney stopped working. She had to have 9 hours of surgery to save her life, and they didn't think she was going to make it through surgery. She was cut from her armpit to her wrist and from her groin to her ankle, where they took veins out of her leg to put into her arm. They didn't think her arm was going to survive. horrific scars, massive staples. She was in the hospital for over a month. And when she got out, she said, she called me Mommy. She was 32 years old. She called me Mommy. I loved it. She said, Mommy, I think God kept me alive so I can help people. And I never forgot that. And when she died, that was my reason I'm here, to help people. Well, it's really important, if you're going through something, if you've lost somebody, not to isolate. This could have gone really bad for me, let me tell you. But I had my a stupid thing, the NA toolbox, almost 23 years worth of it, and then the 8 that I had from before, where the seeds were planted. And I recommitted to my recovery because, let me tell you, I grieved my daughter for 10 years, watching her kill herself. I tried to prepare myself for it. You can't prepare for it. You're just lying to yourself. But I knew it could happen. So I threw myself back into my recovery, into helping people. And like I said, I got really, really sick. I became addicted to my daughter's addiction and trying to save her. Because even though they tell you in here you can love them to death, I was going to love her to recovery. So anyway, since she's been gone, this young lady right here saved me. My daughter sent you to me, because I think I could help anybody. And you asked me to sponsor you, brand new. And I said yes, and you were like awesome. I'm so proud of you. You know, a way to honor our loved ones is just to be the best person we can be. Because you may think they're gone, but they're gone physically, but they're still here. They're watching over us. Don't hold on to any regrets, because I did that. I did that. I had to put the baseball bat down. It's not my fault my daughter died. It's taken me a long time to be able to say that. This is not my fault. I did everything possible. I stayed in recovery so she could see that this program worked, so that I would be here when she walked through that door, and she didn't. But I'm still here. I'm just trying to learn, you know, really. One of the best things I did was I had lost faith. Yeah, I had lost faith. And now, you know, the people in my meetings guided me to where they go for their faith boost. And I do that now. It's the best thing I ever did. It's reconnected me. Grief's gonna come. You know, it's gonna come. Right now, I'm worried about my dog. He's getting old. Actually, it was my daughter's dog. I wouldn't let her take him on the streets with her. He knows me as Gamma. And he's getting old. And that dog has been with me through everything. So I'm like freaking out that I'm going to lose this little precious pup who's like unconditional love, showed me unconditional love. And my dad's getting up there in age, and he's got health issues, and he lives very far from me, so I've only seen him once in the last 5 years physically. And but I know through this program and the people in this program and doing the things that I did when I first came in, which is going to meetings, praying, not picking up, you know, helping a newcomer, working step work. As long as I continue to do that, I'll be okay. And talking about it and being able to cry. And, you know, I will share about this till the day I die. So if you're in meetings and you hear me repeatedly talk about my daughter and my story, I'm trying to save my life. So, anyway, my buddy Jake here, who I met, who is really ironic that we're doing this together, because I'm kind of met you when you were first coming back around, mm-hmm. and you shared your story and I shared mine.
Connected.
We connected, and it was weird when I found out we were doing this together, but awesome. So I'm going to turn the meeting over to you. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. My name is Jake, and I'm an addict. So, I was asked to do this meeting because I'm, you know, through Narcotics Anonymous and God, I'm able to stay clean today, and I got a little over 2 years after losing my wife that we were married. I was married to for 14 years. I met her in NA when I first was introduced to the program. I'm 43 years old. It was back in 2006 when I met her. And it was my first exposure to NA at the time. It was after about 7 years of shooting dope and coke, running from the county. Because back then, in the late 90s and early 2000s, there wasn't a lot of NA in the county. It was mostly in the city. So I wasn't exposed to it. I heard about it, but I wasn't exposed to it. When I finally had enough of getting high, I didn't want to die. I knew that the whole time I was using. And I knew there was a better way. I heard about it, so I decided to give it a shot. I'm the type of guy that's like all in on something. If I make a decision, I go for it. It's no middle. There's no gray area for me. So when I first got clean, I stayed clean. Like when I make a commitment to something, I make a commitment. And that's what I did. It was in the Baltimore area at the Helping Up Mission is where I got clean back in 2006. And I loved the fellowship and I loved NA because you guys showed me that you could have fun in recovery, because I didn't know that was a thing. I knew I had to get clean, but I didn't know I was going to have fun doing it. It's beautiful, right? Because I got my first sponsor, Joey Coop, here, and I got my current sponsor, Lee, both of y'all here for this meeting, so I love you guys. I'm glad you're here. So I met Joey at Little Italy when I was at the Helping Up Mission. That was my home group because it's right by the mission. And I see him in his, you know, his nice ass truck and his gold jewelry. I'm like, man, that's who I want to be. So I made him my sponsor. But anyway, I met Sue. A lot of you in here know her or knew her. I met Sue. I had like about 9 months. She had like 60 days. And she was, it was at Joy Recovery in Hollandtown, and she had booty shorts and corn rolls. I fell in love right away. This is a funny story, right? Because, she, if anybody who knows her, you know, her personality is, she's a, like a type A personality. She speaks her mind no matter what. And, she was outside smoking a cigarette. And when I went up and approached her to talk to her, she looked at me like I had three eyes. And I introduced myself and told her my name, and she said, "Jake, that's a stupid name." Right? That's the first thing she said, right? I was like, damn, okay. So then she walked away. That was it. She wouldn't give me her phone number or nothing. So like I said, I'm a persistent dude. Like when I want something, I go for it. And I was so persistent with her, and I finally scooped her up. And you know, we hit the ground running, and it worked for us because she had her sponsor and her very strong network of women. I had my sponsor, my very strong network of men, and it worked. And we listened to our sponsor. We weren't sponsoring each other. You know, relationships in early recovery are dangerous. If you don't have a strong foundation and a good network of people, and the Baltimore area, if you're, you know, you can't get much better than Baltimore with NA. So I was ingrained in the Baltimore area with my network. So it worked. My career took off. Her career took off. Went from a laborer to a superintendent in 2 years. She went from a hairstylist to a sales consultant within 2 years. Our dual income was ridiculous. So we allowed. I'm going to speak for myself. I allowed money, property, and prestige to divert me, just like the literature says. The meeting attendance started going down after a few years of clean time. It went from going to 4 or 5 meetings a week to 3 a week to 2 a week to just a home group. Then we ended up joining home groups, which was our sponsors suggested not to do. And so all we were going to was our home group. That was it. And then eventually we stopped going to meetings altogether after about 6 years clean, stopped going. We made it a few years without using, just from, you know, my daughter. When I met her, she had a 7-year-old daughter, and I took her as my own. I gave her my last name, adopted her, and she grew up in the rooms, right? So, you know, we had this life, right? You know, this beautiful home, daughter, dog, you know, cars, great careers. So that kind of held it together for a few years. Like, we refused to relapse or use because we didn't want to lose all that stuff. But eventually, the longer we are disconnected from the program, the more we believe the lie, or I'm sorry, the more I believe the lie that I could get high or drink without going back to, you know, shooting dope every day. So 2016, decided to buy a bottle of wine and took a drink, and it went from, you know, drinking once or twice a week to every day within probably a month, and then it only took about a month after that before we were copping dope. So from 2016 to 2020, it was the most toxic relationship I've ever been in my life, ripping and running. Somehow we held our jobs. It was really bad. We tried everything but coming back to the program. We got on methadone, Suboxone, even got a marijuana medical card. I mean, my pride got the best of me. I refused to walk back in the rooms, and it destroyed our lives. So when I got clean the first time in 2006, you know, that was real heroin, right? When I relapsed, it was all fentanyl. So, like, I was chasing this high that didn't even exist anymore. And it, because of that, you know, I overdosed countless times. Narcan has saved my life. Thank God for Narcan. It got to the point where my daughter moved out, and we had Narcan in every single drawer of every room of our house. So instead of getting clean, let's just get more Narcan. So that's what we did, man. And we were just falling out left and right, giving each other Narcan, and kept getting high. It was ridiculous, out of control. So it got to a point where, see, my line wasn't, oh, my daughter's waking me up with Narcan. Oh, my wife is, you know, 80 pounds, and we're, you know, we barely have any money in our bank account, or I'm destroying my life, or we're dying every 3 days and overdosing. That wasn't my bottom. It took for me to get some help. It took my boss to realize that I was getting high. And that was just God working, because that's what I needed. So he pulled me up on the job site, and it was my first piece of honesty in a long time. I told him my piss was dirty, and if you give me a drug test, you're gonna have to terminate me, because I knew the deal. And they were like, oh, well, hold on. So that little piece of honesty kind of saved me there, because they allowed me to get help without me losing my job. So I collected short-term disability and went to rehab. I went for 30 days in Florida. Really, it was just a vacation. I really had no desire to get clean. I mean, I did, but I didn't. You know, like, a part of me, I had reservations out the ass. And it was like a little jail sentence. You know, when you don't want to be in rehab, you feel like 30 days is 5 years. But when you want to be there, like, it goes by really fast. And that's how it was. Like, I was counting the days, and I came home to the same situation that I left in. The one thing I did do, though, is I reconnected with my sponsor, and I did go to a couple meetings when I got out. COVID was still going on, so it was that outside meeting at the park, you remember? And also, there was a woman's rap in the White Marsh area that opened me with welcome arms because I needed to get to a meeting. And it was just like, it's just amazing how NA just kind of just can just scoop you up and get you back on your feet. But at that time, I still wasn't ready. I was still using. And at this time, our wedding rings are off. We're sleeping in separate bedrooms, and it's a nightmare. We're like pretty much, you know, gave up on life at the time, literally. So on October 6th, 2020, at 4:30 in the morning, I woke up to take a piss, and I saw my wife laying on the floor. So I went over there to try to wake her up. She wasn't responsive. She was blue in the face. I knew what was going on. I knew, like, she was gone. But I still tried to give her CPR. I called an ambulance. They told me to give her CPR until they get there. I mean, I knew she was gone. They got there. You know, I was praying and praying, like, hoping, like, there was, you know, they'd be able to get some life back in her. But they weren't able to. And they pronounced her dead at, like, it was 4:55 in the morning. I just lost it, broke down and, you know, into the corner of the house. And there was a moment, and I'll never forget this, and I always share about this when I share my story. There was a moment where I was like, didn't believe what was happening as I was balled up in the corner. Like no way this is happening. There's no way she's gone, right? So I got up and I ran into the room where all the paramedics were. And right as I ran in, they were zipping her up. So I watched them zip up my wife of 14 years. So for a while, I hated God for allowing me to see that. But now I look at it as a good thing because I need to see that. So, like, you know, if I ever think about using, just think about that. You know, that's pain gives me strength today. So the homicide detective came and made a big deal out of it. You know how it is. Well, I don't know if you know how it is, but if you're ever in a situation where there's an overdose, they interrogate you like you killed the person. So I had to deal with that and answer all these questions. And then towards the end, she was like, "You want me to call her mother?" I was like, "Man, no, I'll call her." Like, even though I was a low bottom dope fiend at the time, I still, you know, had my morals that my dad taught me. Like, what kind of man would I be if I let this stranger call her mom? So I called her and had to tell her on the phone that her daughter died. So that was one of the most hardest things I've had to do in my life. It was tough. And then my daughter got on the phone, because at the time she was living with Sue's mother, because she wasn't living with us. She left because we couldn't stop getting high. And she jumped on the phone. She's like, Dad, I know what you're going to do. You're going to go get high. Don't get high. Come over here. Get your stuff. Come over here. And I was like, all right. I'm coming. Well, of course, I found every dollar that I could find in the house, and I went and copped. And I got as high as I could possibly get and then drove to, I sit back and think about that. I drive to Sue's parents' house with my daughter, high as a kite after, you know, they just lost her. I was so caught up in the disease and itself. Like, I didn't think about, you know, everybody else that was grieving, you know. So her memorial service, it's when everyone here showed up, right, at the memorial service. Like, that was my first shot of hope, because I was ready. After the service and I did my speech, I was going to go. I had a premeditation to drive to the city and go kill myself. I was going to speak my piece, clean my bank account out, And Abandoned Miniums was never my story, but it was about to be. Like, I was just ready to just go hard. And then I seen y'all show up in my memorial service, and I was like, wow. Like, that was a shot of hope right there. Like people that I haven't seen in 7-8 years were at her memorial service. And it just, you know, that got me to hold on a little bit longer at the time, just a little bit longer. And then what really did it for me is it was the first real moment of clarity was when I was with my daughter, and she was crying, and I was high as a kite, and I was like, what's wrong? And she's like, Dad, it's not fair. You're an addict. I'm not. You can go get high and cover all the feelings. I can't. You need to get your ass back to rehab and get fucking clean and deal with the feelings like I'm doing. In other words, stop being a pussy. Let's go. And I was like, damn. She's right. Like, I just saw it. Like, everything in front of me. Like, Sue's mom crying. Sue's dad crying. My family. Everybody grieving. Like, all of a sudden, I was like, I got out of self for a minute. I got out of self for a small moment. And decided to call the same rehab that I just came back from and go back down and get help. At the time, I did it for Cameron, my daughter, and I didn't do it for anybody else, but that's what it took. So thank God for her. I call her my co-sponsor. So that's what I did. I went back to Florida, and it was hard at first. It was really hard. I was ready to hop that fence. You know, I had money in my bank account. You know, I was there by will, right? So, like, I wasn't court committed or anything, so I could leave whenever I wanted. It was real hard for me to not hop that fence and go get some. All I could think about, I was like, man, I've never had Florida cocaine. I've never had Florida cocaine. You know it's good down here, right? You know it's good down here. And I just didn't want to be in my own skin, man. It was really hard. You know, that moment, the first few weeks in that rehab was the hardest grieving moment since she passed. That was the hardest time because I didn't have a program. I didn't have a support system. I mean, there was people obviously in the rehab, but I wasn't utilizing them. And it was just me and the disease just sitting there. So instead of me hopping the fence, I decided to talk to my therapist there at the time and ask for some help. Like, what should I do? I'm ready to go use. His suggestion was to call my sponsor. I was like, okay, really? And he was like, yeah, call your sponsor. So I was like, well, I don't have a phone. He's like, here, he gave me my phone. He took it out of the belongings. So I called my sponsor. And I'm like, you know, throwing up all over him on the phone. And he said one simple thing when I was done. He said, pray. And I was mad. I was like, you're going to tell me to pray after all this has happened? I was mad at God. And I was mad at my sponsor for telling me that. I hung up. And I went back in my room pissed off, like as if there was some other magic thing that he could do. You know what I mean? So I held on for a few more days in there, and I finally, all I could kept hearing was your voice in my head, right? So finally I decided to pray for the first time in years. And I'm not even kidding, you know. After that prayer, I felt a little bit better, just a little bit better. And I just got a little bit of hope after that one prayer. So if any of you guys don't believe in God, I'm going to tell you right now. There's something up there, because that's all I had when I was in that facility. It was just me and God. And by taking his suggestion and saying that prayer, it gave me a little hope. So I started praying more and more every day, every night. And I was feeling better and better every day. And then I started listening to what they were saying in the meetings. My ears started opening up. The clouds started lifting. And I started feeling good. I didn't want to die anymore. I had some hope. So it went from me wanting to die and going to get high to not wanting to leave and wanting to live and not wanting to leave. I wanted to stay in that little bubble in Florida as long as possible. I didn't want to look at pictures on my phone. You know, I was dreading that when I came out of treatment, was looking at the pictures of my phone of Sue and everything, and dealing with anything, dealing with my daughter, dealing with my job, everything. So what I did is I'd stay there as long as possible. You could stay there up to 90 days. So that's what I did, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, yeah, that's a really good idea. So, and it helped a lot because it got me through the holidays. Thanksgiving and Christmas was right in that, within those 90 days, and I needed to be there for that. So once I got through the holidays, I felt like I could really do anything at that point, right? I felt like I could maybe do this thing, right? Because every time I dread something and then get through it, I feel better and I'm ready to take another step. So that's what I did, and I was ready to come home. I confidently could say at the time that I could come home and not use and stay clean. I was looking forward to getting reconnected with everybody in the program, looking forward to going back to work, being there for my daughter. Like, it was just my whole perspective on life was changed at this point. So another suggestion that I made, that my sponsor made, that I took was moving into a recovery house when I got out of rehab. At this point, I had got 90 days clean. And my disease is telling me, go get your apartment. You know, you got money. You got 90 days. You're good. But my sponsor's telling me, you're not good. You haven't lived by yourself in 15 years. You think, you know, you're going to be all right just living in an apartment by yourself? So I took that suggestion. And, of course, I picked the bougiest recovery house I could find. But that's what I did. I moved into a recovery house. And hit the ground running. I also took another suggestion to do 90-90 outside of treatment, even though there was 90 meetings in the 90 days I was there. The 90-90 doesn't start till you get out of treatment, and that's what I did. And I needed that. I needed that because it really, really set a foundation for me and forced me to connect with y'all. And I needed that. I didn't have anything else. If my daughter wasn't enough, my job wasn't enough. I needed this program and still need it. To live day to day without allowing the misery to get the best of me. So that's what I did. I did the 90-90, and even after that, the 90 days were up. I still did it for like a month or two. It was, living at the recovery house started getting really tough because with fentanyl out there, everybody's dying, overdoses left and right, and like it got to the point where I felt like it was starting to be detrimental and not, you know. So I wanted to leave, but my sponsor's next suggestion was to wait till I celebrate a year clean before I leave. It's like, man, okay. So I was like, you know, I've taken every suggestion up to this point. Why, you know, don't stop now, right? So that's what I did, and I needed it. I needed it because, not even kidding, a couple weeks later, like two people overdosed in the recovery house, and I needed to see some more pain before I got out of there. But when I celebrated my year, I didn't even hesitate. Literally, that weekend I was celebrating. I had the keys to my apartment. So I felt good, right? I get this little apartment, my little pad, and you know, I felt good about my life. And I took every step that I needed to take to get where I'm at today. You know, the biggest thing that I've learned from my life and the situation that I've been in is that misery is optional. There used to be a meeting, I don't know if it's still around, in East Baltimore called Misery is Optional. And when I used to go to that meeting, like, I thought it was bullshit, just the name of the meeting. I was like, how is it optional, man? If you're miserable, you're miserable. But I learned this time, you know, this time around, I learned that because of being cleaned, the first thing that being clean does, it gives you a choice. We have a choice today. We have a choice to either wake up and oh poor me and think about all the bad shit and crawl into some hole and die, or you get up in the morning, you say your prayers, get your work boots on or your pumps or whatever women wear in the morning, you know, say your prayers and go to work and be there for your family, be there for your daughter, be there for your parents, be there for your brothers and sisters, most importantly, be there for yourself, and that's what I do today. Another thing that I've really gotten out of being back in recovery is when I was in the treatment facility, there was this old timer, his name was Mike, and he had like 40 years sober. He was an AA, so he had 40 years sober, as they say. And he just real old school, man. I love the dude. So every week he had this little meeting, and just like he would just spit like knowledge out every time he talked. A good dude, right? And he saw everything that I was going through. And I was there a long time. I was there 90 days. So, like, you know, when you're there that long, you know, the people that work there and come in there and have their H&I commitments and this and that, you really connect with them, especially if you're, you know, trying to work a program, right? So he asked me, he pulled me up, and he never talks to me one-on-one, and he pulled me up, so I thought I felt important that he was even talking to me, right? So he pulled me up one-on-one, and he asked me if I'm praying. I said, yes, sir, I'm praying. He said, well, are you doing it right? I was like, is there a right way? He's like, there is a right way. And I was like, what's that? He said, to pray on your knees. And I was like, so if I'm not praying on my knees, it's wrong? He said, it's not wrong. But for me, it's right to pray on your knees. We'll never say praying is wrong. But I'm just talking about for me, praying on your knees is the right way to do it. And I said, why is that? And he said, because when you pray on your knees, it's an automatic form of surrender. I was like, okay, makes sense, right? I've been around in the program a long time. It was kind of a little moment there where I was kind of gave me some chills, okay? And I actually kind of forgot what he said for a couple days. And then when he came back the next week, he asked me again, are you praying on your knees? I said, no, Mike, not yet. He said, well, let's get on your knees when you pray. I was like, okay. So still didn't do it. Hard-headed addicts, you know. So the next week, he said it again. I was like, all right, Mike, I'll start praying on my knees. So I did it because I didn't want to hear him say it anymore, right? So I started doing it, and it's a whole nother dimension of prayer for me. And I'm just going to talk for myself. When I prayed on my knees for the first time, because I've never prayed on my knees in my life. I went to Catholic school, but those weren't real prayers. So I got on my knees, and I had a wholehearted prayer for the first time on my knees. And when I stood up, it felt like I literally could feel God inside of me. And just like this presence inside of me, like I was floating. It was the most amazing feeling in my life. And ever since that day, I've always prayed on my knees. So like I'll wake up in the morning, right, in the bed, you know, feeling miserable, like we always do when we wake up in the morning, because we have the disease of addiction who wants us to make us feel like we're a piece of shit every day. And every morning I have that void is there. Because I know I identify myself as an addict for my whole life, because I remember that void since I was 5 years old. That's the disease of addiction. That's the something. There's something there where I always feel like I need to need something outside of me to fill it, right? And today, for the most part, I fill it with Narcotics Anonymous and God, right? Well, every morning I feel that void. Every single morning, when my alarm goes off, I feel like shit every day. That's just who I am. But when I get on my knees and I pray, it goes away immediately. So that's what I do every day. And through Narcotics Anonymous and God, I'm able to stay clean. I got over 2 years now. And I'm positive, right? I enjoy my life today. You know, some people don't even understand how I can even, like, get up in the morning. Like, it's really tough with like Sue's parents, because they're not in the program. They're not God-centered like I am. They don't understand how I can just be happy and have a new wonderful girlfriend that I have now. And like what they just want me to be miserable all the time. Like they don't get what I'm going through, right? But I'm not going to let that and who them allow me from to stop me from what I'm doing, right? That's where they are, and I respect it. You know, people are at points in their life. And they're at that point. I can't get into that and control it or change it, right? I can only focus on myself. And that's what I do every day. So real quick, I got a couple minutes here. First time I was in recovery, I pencil whipped step work. Wasn't working a thorough program, just had a strong network, kept me clean. Relapsed because of it. Now that this time around, I'm working the most thorough program I ever have. I'm actually answering the step work and like listening and paying attention. We have a tradition study we do once a month, which is great. I actually listen to people in the meetings and I take suggestions today. So grief in recovery, right? Yeah, grief, it happens. You know, when someone dies, you're going to miss that person, right? What helps me is this, NA, working steps, going to meetings, calling my sponsor, and praying. That's how I get through my grief. Sorry.
All right. I would like to thank our speakers. Please don't forget to visit the merchandise and hospitality areas. And can we close this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thanks,
Pete. Thanks. Thanks, Father. Good job.
Sure. That's good.